Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Nevada Court of Appeals. I don't know if you've been in this courtroom before, but it still feels new to me. It's been almost 6 years now, but we really enjoy having arguments. And this is a pro bono case, so it would be set for argument regardless. Has some very interesting issues. So again, we're happy to be here today. I'm joined by Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left, Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right, and counsel today we have in the courtroom and maybe somebody online, we'll see. So Mr. Anderson, hey, thanks again for taking this case pro bono. And do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor,
5 minutes. Okay, all right. And Mr. Garcia?
No.
Okay. Do you think Ms. Tammy Cowden is going to be joining us or not? I'm sorry.
Your Honor, I know she's trying to log on. She has a Zoom call for whatever reason. It's not cooperative.
Okay. Were you planning on making the argument yourself, though?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I'm prepared to go forward.
All right. For the record here, this is case 82599-COA and case 83771-COA. Karen Wei Gao and Xiao Gang. This is a consolidated appeal, so the time for argument is just the normal 15 minutes per party. Judge Shibola, would you like to say anything before we officially start?
Welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today. Thank you again for taking the pro bono and for all the hard work that you all do on behalf of your clients.
Okay. Thank you. Judge Westbrook?
Thank you both so much for appearing today. I'm looking forward to an excellent oral argument from you both.
All right. The fan's off in here right now. When the fan goes on, which is frequently, it's hard to hear sometimes. So if you don't hear us for some reason, please ask us to repeat and just speak up just in case it does come on. So we'll start with the appellant's case here today. Mr. Anderson, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Elliot Anderson. This is a case about broken promises. Mr. Gang promised two separate times to take care of Karen for the rest of her life. After those promises fell apart, the parties attempted to settle their differences when filing for divorce. But as would be common, Mr. Gang showed that he had no intention of living up to his agreements. He reneged on his agreements for the third time. He acted as though no settlement agreement had been reached. Karen made substantial sacrifices to be with Mr. Gang. She gave up lucrative work in China. She crossed an ocean. And she did so expressly on the promise that he would take care of her for the rest of her life, no matter what. He broke these promises, and that is why we are here today. In the family court case, two grounds for reversal exist. First, the court could hold that the professional negligence release term is not material. Second, the court could enforce a confession of error. In the district court case, this court need only hold, rather the civil division case, this court need only hold that Karen's common law claims do not fall within the family court's exclusive jurisdiction to reverse. Unless the court has any questions, I intend to focus my oral argument on the family court case given the more factual issues. However, I am prepared to discuss both if the panel has any questions. Parties agreed to terms in a video conference.
Well, just one question about the jurisdiction issue before we move on. The order from the district court is very brief. There's no authority cited within the order, but there was an extensive discussion at the hearing. In the second to the last line on page 2, the court concluded that it lacks subject matter jurisdiction and that Karen's claims should be heard in the family court. Are those separate grounds for why the district court dismiss the case?
Your Honor, no, I don't believe that there are separate grounds. I believe that there was one ground, just subject matter jurisdiction, and that was the only decision that the district court made. There was briefing on a 12B5 motion as well, but the district court took pains to explain that its order would just reach a simple jurisdictional determination. And although it didn't cite the statute, we believe that it was the, you know, the tried and true family court jurisdiction statute in NRS 3.
Mr. Anderson, let me follow up on something you said when you started your argument, which is broken promises basically are why we're here, and that the parties attempted to settle their differences when filing for divorce. Is your position that whatever oral agreement existed before the filing of the divorce was then subsumed in the divorce proceeding?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand your question. Were you?
One of the things that the district court judge focused on at the hearing in terms of the jurisdictional issue was that the issues that the parties were raising were really issues that were related to the divorce proceeding. That the issues regarding the oral argument, or if we want to characterize it, I don't know if you do characterize it as a premarital agreement, but those issues were then part of the divorce itself or the divorce proceeding itself. And therefore, to the extent that they may have been independent beforehand, now that the parties have moved for divorce, they were subsumed in the divorce proceeding. Do you disagree with that?
I do, Your Honor. Our position is that the complaint should be judged at its four corners. That's the standard of review that we're in for subject matter jurisdiction. When there's a factual dispute, we're entitled to have those factual disputes resolved in our favor. Otherwise, we're with the four corners of the complaint. We have a...
Is it your position that the factual dispute was not resolved by the family court?
Yes, Your Honor. But I didn't really see, you know, the record is somewhat limited. The main issue that was fought about was the motion to enforce settlement agreement. The parties had, you know, there wasn't really a lot of back and forth about that discussion in the family court from what my review of the record.
Do you believe that the parties in preparing or discussing the agreement that was at issue in the family court proceeding, do you believe that the oral agreement, the premarital oral agreement, I'm going to take care of you for the rest of my life, or your life rather, was that something that was then placed in the written agreement that was considered by the family court?
I would, let me try to answer this way. I do believe that that settlement agreement that we talk about, the third promise, was meant to resolve all the existing claims between the parties. There is a general release term between the parties at the record and first record on appeal 210. There is a parties release term as well. So theoretically, if we get there, we would have to consider, you know, whether that was subsumed there, but we're just not here yet as to whether that was subsumed by that release. As to the family court case resolving it, I just didn't see that reflected in the record from my review. But that said, there could be a potential issue if the court reverses. We would have to consider whether that release term applies to the district court action, the civil division action, rather, as to one of the claims subject to the settlement agreement. I'm not sure if I got at that the right way.
Do you think family court could have resolved the issue of the oral, let's call it an oral contract, pre-marriage? Do you think the family court could have resolved that issue?
If it were brought there, I'm not sure about that, Your Honor, because we do have the interplay of two constitutional provisions. You have the general jurisdiction of civil courts, or of justice courts and district courts, and then you also have subparagraph 2 that talks about the original exclusive family jurisdiction. So, you know, there is an argument there, and we think that there ought to be at least some sort of a clean break as to what gets brought in the family court, because they are courts of limited jurisdiction and subject matter generally.
That's related to your argument, though, that Landreth should be overruled, correct?
That's correct.
Not something our court can do.
That's correct.
So under existing law, you would agree that the family court could have heard the breach of contract issues?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what those cases stand for. We take issue with them. We don't think that they're well reasoned based upon the plain text of the Constitution, strict construction of subject matter jurisdiction statutes. And if the court feels like it can't be resolved here, would, you know, appreciate that, you know, any sense of potentially this is something that the Supreme Court should take a look at if the court does have that impression. So I do recognize that we are stuck with what we have in terms of that case law, given where we are.
Why wouldn't it have been more efficient for one court to handle all of the related claims between the parties? Because essentially what we had in this case was very, very similar claims. I mean, essentially everything was identical except for in the amended complaint that she filed, or I guess the second amended complaint she filed in the district, the general district court, she removed the allegations dealing with the promise to marry. I mean, essentially, we have the same parties. She's asking for the house. She's asking for support. It's pretty much the exact same relief that she's seeking in both. Why wouldn't it have been more efficient? And why wasn't it more efficient and proper for the family court to resolve everything?
I take your point, Your Honor. My argument would just be separation of powers is inefficient. This was committed to the legislature to decide what to put in there. If the family court law section wanted to go to the legislature and make sure that this was tuned up to allow that efficiency, the legislature had that power. Our position is that given the separation of powers concerns brought up when you talk about subject matter jurisdiction, that they should be strictly construed. And even if that means it has to be a little bit more inefficient, that that's the right result under the law and our system of separation of powers.
But that assumes that we overrule Landreth, or that the Supreme Court were to overrule Landreth, because under existing law right now, it would be concurrent under your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And that's why we've asked for those to be reconsidered. But again, understand that that's not the situation. There's not that ability to have that result here today.
Well, we spent a whole lot more time on jurisdiction than you planned on.
Yes, Your Honor.
You want to go to your key argument regarding the family law matter?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Moving on to the family court facts that I wanted to bring to the court's attention today. The parties agreed the terms in a video conference. Both parties contemporaneously confirmed the same in emails. At the record in 217, first volume, Reckon on Appeal, we have my client Karen saying, "You made some, but not all of the changes we have agreed on." Magic words, agreed on. In the supplemental appendix and testimony, she also testified that that the parties reached an agreement in a conference call. Mr. Gang said something similar through counsel at one record on appeal, 223. He said, Mr. Gang agreed that this revised version incorporates all the changes we've agreed on. I did want to briefly touch on the material term aspects given my remaining time. The professional negligence release term is not a release between the parties. That's the bottom line. Release terms can oftentimes and are most regularly material when between the parties. But that's just not the situation we have here. There is no duty of law of care owed to my client from Nevada Family Law Group. And given that, this is just a superfluous term. It's not material. As a matter of law, there is no duty owed to an adverse party. And so there's no reason to include a release of those terms.
Counsel, let's say we agreed with you that that wasn't a material term. Judge Harder's decision actually relied on two separate grounds, didn't it? So there was the first one, which was the second one was the one you challenged, the lack of agreement on the material term. But then there was one that you did not appear to challenge, which was the factual finding that that Karen admitted that there wasn't a settlement agreement. It's in there. He said that, you know, it happened at the evidentiary hearing and in her 221 motion for attorney's fees. That factual finding that she admitted that there was no settlement seemed to be the primary basis for the court's decision, was it not?
Your Honor, that's not the way that I read the order. I do know that he put that in there, but I don't really characterize that as a finding of fact. This is a pro se litigant saying we didn't agree. She was referring to the execution of it. So this is an error of law on her part. It's her idea of what it means to have a contract. But we all know that you can have a binding agreement without a signature. And if you look at the redirect testimony, in that where she's asked about that, and she explains exactly right there. Given the fact that this settlement fell apart because of one term and one term only, that the finding is not properly supported by the facts, given the contemporaneous evidence and given the totality of the evidence. And with, unless there's any other follow-up questions, I'd like to reserve what time I have left.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. All right, Mr. Garcia.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jordan Garcia, and I'd like to address, I think, first the civil case, and then I will talk about the family law case. Mr. Gang, and what happened in this case is an unusual. Mr. Gang wanted to reconnect with an old flame, and he went to Ms. Guo, made a romantic gesture saying, you know, if you marry me, I'll take care of you for the rest of your life. And that's what they did. They actually went and had a marriage ceremony in China, came to the U.S. They got married here. And, you know, they had all these hopes and dreams like everybody does when they got married. You know, Ms. Guo had a job that was in finance over there in China. And my client was, unfortunately, has Parkinson's and he didn't work, but he had saved enough money from investing. He didn't need to. And so Ms. Guo came to the court on the civil matter and said, you know, this was a contract. Now, whether I agree with it, a contract or not, that was questionable from the get-go. But let's assume that it was. Then what Ms. Guo said, which was in her own statements to the divorce court, was that this was a promise made for the purposes of marriage. And so what that promise did was when she said it was for marriage, it pulled it out of a contract in civil court and laid it in under the jurisdiction of the family court.
Counsel, if you look at the plain language of NRS 3.223 sub 1, it says that the family court has original exclusive jurisdiction in any proceeding. And then in sub A, brought pursuant to Title 5 of NRS Chapter 31A, and then it lists a number of other chapters, specific yes. chapters, that it has to be brought pursuant to those, you know, those sections. Was her contract claim brought pursuant to any of those?
Well, it should have been, because under NRS 122, marriage is a civil contract, and that is underneath that. And the rights that form under a marriage contract are defined by NRS 123. And NRS 125 deals with how we litigate and deal with those conflicts that come up with the rights that come out of 123 and 122. So the what she alleged would have fallen under those statutes.
But she didn't need to bring it pursuant to those statutes in order to assert that there was a contractual promise.
I believe she would have, because it's a marriage contract, and that the marriage contract and NRS 3223 require that. Otherwise, anybody would have the ability to determine, well, I don't think this is my claim under marriage, and throw it into the civil court. And we would have this dynamic where people are filing stuff in civil court only to be thrown out into family court or vice versa. Or even worse, we have what could have happened in this case, which is we have a civil court making one decision on the same facts and circumstances, and a family court making a different decision on the same facts and sets of circumstances, and we would have a conflict potentially.
Well, so, what do you say to Mr. Anderson's argument that essentially her amended complaint took out every allegation that related to the marriage and expressly, you know, didn't have any allegations related to marriage? Does that why don't we look to the four corners of the pleading?
Because she still had a pleading pending in divorce court admitting that was what happened. She did not amend her marriage divorce complaint. Divorce answer, I should say, because it was an answer, to state that it wasn't about marriage.
Is that what you were reading during the hearing?
Yes, absolutely. That was what I read out orally into the record.
So was there any response to that? I mean, that seemed pretty compelling. You're reading that. This is what she said there. Now she's here saying something else.
And that was my general belief, was that was fairly conclusive about that issue. And I think the district court judge agreed with me on that.
Didn't she actually say though that didn't she actually say though that it was in contemplation of a sort of ceremonial marriage in China that had nothing to do with the marriage that was going to happen in the United States? Wasn't that her explanation?
Kind of. It was very unclear what she was saying. She was saying a number of different things. I felt that she was backpedaling quite a bit in what she was stating to the court. Her statements that she had the time to think about, write, and look at, I think are more informative than the statements she made orally when she was kind of on the fly. And so that my belief is that written statement is a more truthful or more full statement of her beliefs.
Is the district court allowed to make a sort of a judgment call about credibility in this type of a motion to dismiss?
I don't think it needed to make a judgment call on credibility at that point. I mean, her statements, if you make a written statement to a court, verified, filed with the court, then the court has the ability to rely on that without questioning whether the person really meant what they said when they wrote it down there. And I think the court didn't need to jump to the question of, is she credible what she's saying now versus what she put in writing?
Does the fact that she's a non-native English speaker, unrepresented by counsel, have any bearing on the court's ability to make that kind of determination?
I think it's possible that could be the case, but I don't think that's true in this case. And Judge Harder, in the divorce case, actually addressed that issue, recognizing the fact that she's been in the U.S. for a long time. She was Yale educated on a master's degree. You know, she is a very intelligent and well-educated person, not only in China, but here. She'd written her pleadings competently throughout the litigation, showing that she had the ability to read, understand, and respond in English. And I believe that findings in the divorce case show that she didn't need any special consideration for her language barriers. If there's no further questions, I'll proceed.
Go ahead.
What the claims amount to is that she wanted money in the civil court case for this promise. And that promise and money is generally what we would call family law the world, alimony. And in the divorce case, she ended up choosing not to pursue the alimony. She pled it. It was actually argued through the case. But at the time of trial, she dropped that issue. To me, that's dispositive almost on the entire issue alone, that she didn't choose to pursue her own claims for what would be monetary damages in this case, or alimony in family law world.
Well, let me just ask this question. I believe it was Mr. Gang's attorneys who prepared the settlement agreement, the proposed divorce settlement agreement. So was the purpose of that agreement to essentially reduce to written terms this whole prior oral argument of, I come to the United States and you will take care of me for the rest of my life? Was that concept, that oral agreement, supposed to be incorporated into the settlement agreement, the marital settlement agreement? Was that the plan, or was that discussed, or was the oral agreement still somehow separate from the divorce agreement?
At the time that the settlement discussions were occurring, the complaint in the civil matter had not yet been filed. So the idea that there was this other civil complaint out there that she was going to bring was not contemplated at the time of the settlement, because the parties, or at least Ms. Guo, had not asserted that claim at that point. So it wasn't contemplated because nobody was aware that that was going to be an issue.
Wasn't there a reference to alimony, though, in the marital settlement agreement?
There was, absolutely.
And that was supposed to be a lump sum of $100,000?
That's correct.
So is that the type of alimony, though, that that they wanted to enforce?
Yes, and I mean, my reading of this is that Ms. Guo's essentially claim is that she wants the $100,000.
She wanted the agreement enforced.
Right, which would be, for her side of the terms, the $100,000. My client had a number of other things he wanted out of the agreement.
Was that term ever in dispute between the parties?
As to the amount, or
that
term should be in there? It was negotiated. But at the time that we were discussing it, we had kind of finalized that was the number we were working with.
And that was the number that was going to be characterized as lump sum alimony.
Correct.
Is that why she did not pursue separate alimony, because it was already contained in the marital settlement agreement?
I couldn't speak to what she thought, but we had, again, there was a timing frame from when we dismissed, agreed to dismiss with the intent to refile. And so there was never the idea that she couldn't have brought that claim separately. It was a continuity of when in the first divorce case was closed out, the second one, and the idea was to continue with that divorce case in that second case.
Brought which claims separately?
The claims for the civil claims. She didn't give an exact amount in the what she wanted for the civil claim, but the $100,000 was the amount that we talked about for lump sum alimony.
Okay. So did you see her civil? The oral contract, the civil oral contract, is separate from the alimony?
It was unclear, to be quite honest. She never exactly stated what the relief that she wanted was in the civil matter, other than presumably money of some sort. It wasn't clear based on her complaint.
So in the civil complaint, I think initially, wasn't she seeking support of $5,000 a month for 3 years? All are part of the Echo Shire residence, and $100,000 to replace money taken from the safety deposit box.
That was some of what she said. She had some other things
one.
In there as well. It was difficult to ascertain.
And then in the second amended complaint, she was seeking $500,000, and then I think the entirety of the Echo Shire residence. So
correct. So,
but those are similar to the same types of relief she would be seeking in the family.
Correct. Those are the same kinds of
same
issues
remedies
that were brought up and would have been brought up in the divorce case, or potentially.
And there's no reason that couldn't have been addressed in the divorce case had she decided to pursue those as opposed to enforcing the settlement.
Correct. All those issues are squarely within NRS 125 that would be addressed by the divorce court. A residence, whether it's sole or separate property, any alimony, whether it's lump sum, any other those types of issues would certainly fall within the statute. Real quickly, I wanted to address briefly that the court did, in the district court in the civil case, did address the necessary that it should be in writing. The judge had discussed throughout the proceedings in that hearing that, in fact, specifically he stated that, there was... In essence, regardless if this type of contract, it appears to me potentially would have to be in writing of some sort. And he talked after that in a bit about that. And the reason that's important is because, both in this case and in the divorce case, there's, NRS 123-270, which is we have to have these contracts in marriage and marriage settlements in writing and signed on by these parties. It's a special requirement in the statutes that is important because it avoids the kind of conflicts where oftentimes there's not alternative sources besides the statements between the two parties, and you end up with a he said, she said scenario. And so the judge recognizing that is the statute and that we have some difficulties without this in writing, that was a basis. I believe the court ultimately found under 12b1. But 12b5 is still a relevant reason that it could be dismissed as well. I want to talk a little
bit. Did you add anything to that? My question I asked at the outset about the order I think you drafted. It says the court dismisses it for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and that her claim should be heard in family court, currently pending in case number such and such. Is that to be read as two different points in the same sentence or one point?
I believe it's two points because the judge recognized throughout the hearings that there were some issues like this, as well as some claims for attorney's fees and some other things that he did not want to make a decision on at that point, other than to say, look, I want to address the 12b1 issue and allow any other issues that the parties wish to raise, which in case the 12b5 issue, which is also falls into the issues of the family court, at least not the 12b5, but the underlying NRS 123-270 issue.
So for all the subjective reasons why the case should be in family court versus an objective reason, there simply is no jurisdiction.
Correct.
And of course, you've argued that on appeal, so I assume you're sticking with that.
Yes, yes. I want to talk a little bit about the divorce case as well. I mean, fundamentally, the idea that there's a contract, there's an agreement, is not supported by the testimony in the trial. In fact, Ms. Gwell stated that there was three major changes that she wanted, not just this one that they focused on. And my client specifically said one of the things, not the one that they've said, which is an indemnification for fees, but one for whether or not attorney's fees can be granted if somebody were to bring the case back to the court. And that was very, very important for my client because he did not want to go back to court again. And having attorney's fees be awarded to somebody who's defending that was very important to him.
How do you respond to Mr. Anderson's argument in his reply brief that you've essentially confessed error by not citing to the record, you know, for any of these other discrepancies in the argument section of your answering brief?
There was citations throughout this statement of facts and on the record and in the record, but I don't. For the most part, this is really an argument is whether there's an agreement or not, and the simple fact is there wasn't, based on those statements that were put into the statement of facts. Specifically, that some of those things I just cited.
Okay. All right, Mr. Garcia, thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
All right, we're back to Mr. Anderson for the rebuttal with just under 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, everything I heard related to the civil case was a factual dispute. These are factual disputes. Reasonable inferences are taken our way here. The district court said in his oral findings that he wanted to take pains that it was a simple jurisdictional determination. That's what the court's findings were, so I would read the ambiguity the other way, given the extrinsic evidence, so to say. Looking at pages 4 to 6 of the answering brief in the civil case, I didn't see any citations to NRS 123, 124, 1 and 25. In response. And so I don't really feel able to respond to that. So I'm going to formally object to any of that argument being considered, given that we didn't have citations to a specific basis in any of those chapters on pages 4 to 6. Moving on to the family court case, I would urge the court to look at the redirect testimony of Karen's testimony. She was very clear that what she meant was that she thought that you had to sign it. And so that's really an error of law. It's not a factual finding. It goes against all of the other evidence in the case, including the contemporaneous emails. And again, those record sites are at 217 and 223 where the parties agree. There's no discussion of attorney's fees. There's discussion of the professional negligence release term and confirming jurisdiction to ensure that there's no collateral attack on the judgment. That's the only discussion that you see contemporaneously. The district court's findings wholly ignore the whole weight of evidence. It's not supported by substantial evidence. It's clearly erroneous calling a term material when the settlement fell apart 2 months before that lawsuit, the civil case came. That district court order is, or that family court order is not supported by substantial evidence. It is clearly erroneous. It doesn't make any sense when you look at all of the evidence in the case. The only thing that we've heard in response to this, and the reason it wasn't addressed was because it's just an error of law. This is a pro se litigant who's a non-native speaker saying what her idea of, well, she didn't have counsel at this time, said we tried to settle. What she meant was that it wasn't executed. That's the only thing that fell apart here.
Mr. Anderson, what would you like the district court, the family district court judge to do? I mean, what does your vision of remand look like on this?
I don't know that there has to be a remand, Your Honor. I think that it can be remanded with instructions, if anything, or just a reversal in enforcing the agreement. This is all the record evidence is there. The court can make a determination and set aside the finding and enforce the settlement.
But you said there were questions of fact.
For the civil case, Your Honor, not for the family court case.
So you think the family court case can be resolved as a matter of law?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I see Ms. Cowden joined us online. I don't know when she joined us, but at least she got to hear part of this. Is there anything, Ms. Cowden, you want to say?
She's muted.
All right, hearing nothing then, we'll take this case under submission for a written decision in the near future, actually two cases consolidated. We thank counsel for the excellent work on this case and the helpful arguments made here today. And Mr. Anderson and Ms. Cowden for taking this through the pro bono program. It's
my apologies. There were technical difficulties. They had to send me a different code, but I was live streaming it at the same time, so I did get to hear it. I thank you for the court's indulgence in allowing me to try at least to attend remotely.
Okay. Well, thank you. Then I don't have to tell you what a good job Mr. Anderson did. You saw it. Okay. Well, and hopefully, Mr. Garcia, you'll be here on
a live stream, so I don't know if you heard me.
Hopefully, you'll be joining us on a pro bono case, too. Maybe you can bring Mr. Pickard, too.
Yeah.
All right, anything else?
No. Thank you both for the excellent oral argument today.
Thank you.
We're being recessed.